All right, welcome to Under the Scales. We have a distributed Under the Scales studio today. We're talking with Washington, the Washington State on the Pacific Coast. And over there we have Yosarian Kelly. Hello, Yosarian. How are you?
Very well, Tom. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. And I have to mention that in the Princeton, New Jersey studio, I have a guest. And his name is Scott Gray. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Tom. Hi-yo.
Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
All right. Been good.
Welcome back from Asia.
Yeah. It's good to be home.
So Scott was just in Thailand and Shanghai?
Shanghai, yeah.
Business and pleasure.
Even the business was pleasurable.
Nice.
That's ideal.
Yeah, it is.
So Yosarian goes way, way back with Scott, I think, and goes not as far back with me because I met Yosarian through Scott. And Yosarian goes way back with Fish and way further back with the Grateful Dead and is a very long-time Fish fan and has been part of the scene for a long time. And Yosarian, let's just start out with, like, you know, Tom Marshall's famous question. Have you seen 300 Fish shows?
Not 300. I'm somewhere close to 170. I think a show or two away, to not be exact, but pretty close to.
Okay,
a couple shows away from 170.
I would have almost sworn that you were 300 in the 300 club.
Yeah, that sort of makes you not really qualify for Under the Scale.
Oh, let's get back together 140 shows from now.
Full disclosure, I've only seen 99. So
Scott's at 99.
Yeah. Oh.
So I'm
you're on the edge of 100. How many shows have you seen, Tom? I'm curious about that.
Well, David Steinberg helped me figure out that my 300th was early in 2016.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, I would have thought you would have seen a lot.
So you are qualified
more,
for Under the Scales.
Yeah, I'm qualified for Under the Scales, but just. Now, let's go a little tiny bit, if you wouldn't mind, Yosarian, just, you know, clarify what I meant by you go way back with the Grateful Dead, because you go way back.
Yeah. I was born into the scene. Essentially, my father did a lot of artwork for the Grateful Dead and knew them in their early years, like the first 2 years that the Grateful Dead were around. He started doing artwork for them, well known for, I don't know, 8 or so Grateful Dead album covers. Europe 72, Mars Hotel, Skeleton and Roses, American Beauty, Working Man's Dead, the first album, Terrapin Station.
So not just...
Again, Yosarian, who's your father?
Alton Kelly of Kelly Moss Studios.
Yeah, Alton Kelly.
So yeah. Alton Kelly and your father's partner was Stanley Mouse, and together they were kind of the Grateful Dead artists, sort of the de facto Grateful Dead artists. Awesome.
Yeah, Rick Griffin in there too. So Rick Griffin and Victor Moscoso and Wes Wilson, my father and Stanley made up what they call the Big Five poster artists. I guess it was... As an art form, posters reemerged in the 60s, and my father was part of that reemergence. And so I was born in 1967 in the Haight-Ashbury, and a couple of my earliest memories were around some members of the Grateful Dead. But I didn't really know what they were about or anything until I was in my early teens when I finally went to go see them for the first time.
So did you, did you hang out with Jerry and the members of the Dead at all?
Yeah, but, you know, my mom and dad were never married. So my mom decided to move to the East Coast for a while, and she started studying, you know, some real hippie stuff, macrobiotics, like a fully vegan diet and meditation. And so she went to Boston with me, and she went first, and my dad and I drove across the United States in a Volkswagen van. This is all stories I've heard, painted in checkers with a giant Borden cow ad on the front of the van. And he had a job at Woodstock, so he brought me to Woodstock at 2.5 years old.
Wow.
And worked at Woodstock, and then went down to Boston to you know, bring me to my mom. And he got a job for a little while at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, but decided he still didn't like the East Coast and ultimately went back. So when I'd visit my dad in San Francisco, that's when I would meet, you know, these different, you know, what are now considered big rock stars. But I think at the time, you know, they were just friends and folks out there. And so I remember, you know, seeing Bob Weir at a Sausalito flea market and going to the Grateful Dead office, where most of the time I just sit in the car because I didn't want to go hang out with my dad's friends or whatever.
Right. Like none of us do, you know, none of us want to hang out with our dad's friends. Like, come on.
Yeah. So, you know, I saw them around a little bit, but I didn't, you know, the Grateful Dead to me sounded like a really scary heavy metal band. So I wasn't really necessarily into that.
So like your father did a lot of really, really famous posters. We know, like you said, like Europe 72 and like Skull and Roses and American Beauty and all these things. Okay. So what is your own personal, poster collection like?
I've got a lot of stuff. You know, when my dad gave me stuff when I was young, I didn't take very good care of it. But I, you know, I had a Volkswagen van and I started going on Grateful Dead tour. And that's, you know, I was living in Washington at this point. My mom brought me up to Washington, where her family's from. So I had many generations in Washington State. So to go to Grateful Dead shows, for the most part, I'd have to go to California at the very least and tour outside of California as well. But I'd drive down there, go visit my dad. He'd give me some posters. I'd put them in my Volkswagen van, which I was sleeping in and pretty much living in a lot of the time. And, you know, I'd destroy them. They'd get bent or moldy or, you know, a stain on it or whatever. So I've kept all that stuff. And then as I got older, I kept better care of stuff. And
sometimes the patina is what makes old things valuable, but unfortunately not posters.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I've got a poster like my, you know, the turning point for me seeing the Grateful Dead was my third show, Vanita Field Trip in 1982. And my dad was there and he introduced me to, you know, Ken Kesey and Bill Graham and, you know, some other people backstage there. And I got an autographed poster from Ken Kesey.
Nice.
And I still have it, but it's in like four pieces. I mean, it molded, you know, so I keep fantasizing about framing it with, you know, it's what's the style of the Japanese pottery where they, you know, if the pot breaks, then they use gold to bring it back together. And it's this kind of fine piece of art. I think I'm going to have to do something like that.
Nice. Nice. Well, we want, you know, I was hoping for a story with a happy ending. Like you have something, something that, you know, Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir and all the members sign a picture of you and they're holding you up as a young child or something.
Like in The Lion King? What are you talking about?
Yes. Yeah.
This is Yosair.
I do have Bobby and Jerry's autograph at the very first Grateful Dead show that I went to as a, you know, my parents brought me to shows when I was little and I don't have any memory of them and probably brought me to Grateful Dead shows. But the very first one I went to, I was 13 and I did go backstage and meet them before I'd even heard their music. I still thought it might be a heavy metal band and I did get their autograph and that's framed. So I still have that.
Okay, good. And then how about like interactions that you remember? Anything with Jerry? I'm just, you know, that's just for my personal curiosity.
Yeah, that first show, I just met him twice. And that first show in 1980, Ramrod brought me backstage, introduced me to Bobby and Jerry, and, you know, introduced me as Alton Kelly's son. And Jerry said, "Oh, you're a familiar melon." So, you know, I took that as I looked familiar because I looked like my father. And then I heard the music and I was like, wow, this is kind of country. And I actually didn't really like it at first. You know, that whole, I probably left the show early even. And then in 1985... By 1985, I actually, you know, they were the best thing on earth for me. And I followed him, you know, East Coast tour, and I was in Florida, and I was backstage again, and Jerry came out warming up before the show on his guitar, just, you know, not plugged in or anything, but just standing there playing his guitar. So I decided to go say hello to him, and I said, you know, "Hi, I'm Alton Kelly's kid. We met once before." And he said, "Oh, the familiar melon." You know, this is 5 years later.
He remembered it.
And I took it as this huge compliment. And then later read through one of the Grateful Dead tell-alls. I, I'm not sure which book it was, but, you know, either one of the band members or one of the roadies wrote a Grateful Dead book. And he mentions Garcia using the term melon for, like, the random heads in the crowd, you know, all these random stuff. So while I took it as a compliment, it was maybe not quite derogatory, but it was certainly not complimentary. So
it's kind of funny. He probably, like, looks out and thinks about, like, every one of those heads as a melon, kind of
right, like a farm.
Ocean of melons,
yeah,
like at a farm.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. So you were one of those, yeah, at least so. You were a familiar melon. So I think it's a compliment.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I do too.
Now then, how did you, I guess some people going from the Dead to Fish is sort of seamless. Some people it's more traumatic. Did you have a seamless transition?
It was not seamless. In 1989, I lived with a deadhead who was into Fish. He was from the East Coast and he had Hunta. And I listened to it and I thought it was amazing. I mean, it really did. I thought, like, Divided Sky and Yam and Golgi, I'm the kind of guy that, like, once I hear a song I really like, I'll play it constantly, like, annoy people. I play it so much and then I'll get tired of it and I'll stop listening. So I did that with those three songs or so off Hunta. And then in 91, I think that was the first time Fish ever toured the West Coast. I was fortunate enough to know ahead of time that they were coming, and I went and saw them at the Evergreen State College, 4691, and there was like 30 people there. They moved it from like the basketball stadium into the library because there were so few people. So, and you know, I was really impressed with their musicianship, but it was really quirky, and you know, they wouldn't stick to a groove, and it didn't feel like it went very deep for me. I remember the first time I heard Fluffhead, I just thought it was amazing. But at this point, and this is where I want to make sure I express my apologies to Tom, there was some point here in the early to mid 90s, 94 to 96, where I used the term that they were hurting for lyrics. Like, lyrically, I just thought it was the most ridiculous band that there was. And so let me add some flavor to that. But
flavor,
you know,
I'm already devastated. Well, flavor is just going to, like, be salt in the wounds.
Well, the funny part is, I mean, it spreads all the way out till just a couple of few years ago where, you know, I really realized that Fish was now my favorite band. It used to be the Grateful Dead. And, you know, I went through this long, over a course of a couple of decades, transition from, you know, the Grateful Dead were the only band in the world. And then there's all these other bands and Fish is one of them too. In 96, I realized this is the greatest live band, rock and roll band that's currently playing. And that was, of course, after Garcia was gone. And then there were points where I was like, well, the Grateful Dead have my heart and Fish has my, I don't know, dancing shoes or something. I wasn't really sure what Fish had. But I went and saw Further a few years ago in Eugene. And it was a great show. But it really was clicking with me that, you know, the Grateful Dead have all these songs about, like, addiction and death and depression and you know, sad songs that would make you cry. And of course the Grateful Dead could scare you too. And you know, when I go see Fish shows, I mean, they make me laugh and just feel incredible joy. Not that the Grateful Dead don't do that, but there's this vast difference between stuff. And, you know, the one gift that I think both bands has is that, you know, their lyrics, you know, evolve with you. You know, there's no overt sense of what these songs are about. And, you know, Robert Hunter stated before that he doesn't like telling people what he wrote them about because often he'd hear the interpretation that he found was actually a better interpretation than what it originally meant. And I'm not sure what your philosophy is, Tom, but
that's kind of what I say.
Sure. These songs have evolved and, you know, there are silly, you know, incredibly silly songs that make you laugh. And then there's songs that are more serious. I mean, it took me, like, I got to see Icarus in my first show and didn't get to see another one until like 2013 or something, 14. And I didn't even know about the children are old enough to be too ridiculous. I didn't even get it. So.
Look at her face tonight.
I guess I'm still a little slow at catching on to some of the humor, and you can tell, you know, my belief that, you know, Tom and Trey must have an amazingly good time writing together, because you can hear that humor come through in the music.
And I think he smiles as he sings it too. Like, you know, I watch him sometimes, and I'm thinking about the writing as he's singing it on stage. And sometimes, like, if he knows where I am, he'll look at me for certain lines, and I have a feeling we're both thinking of exactly the moment of inception, you know. But yeah, you're right. We do have a great time. And that's perceptive.
I just want to add something, you're saying, like, it's like, I think you're right. You probably don't want to know what some of these songs are about. Like you said, like, some of them sound goofy and you know, funny or whatever. But then, like, after talking to Tom for a little bit about them, you find out that actually, like, they're very sinister.
Oh yeah, I've learned a couple of actual what they're supposedly about, and you know, sometimes I've been laughing to myself inside of a show during some serious song, and you know, someone would make the mistake of asking why I was laughing, and I would tell them because I'd shift their view of what a song meant permanently, you know.
Yeah, and, yeah, it's really not, like, fair.
It's a strong weapon. I don't think I should use that very often.
No. Just because, like, you've figured out sort of a secret of how to sort of decipher the code now, you can't tell other people that. In fact, actually, I sort of noticed you. This is something that ties the three of us together. Scott is a great storyteller, an online storyteller, and he's known for that, like on Fantasy Tour. And I kind of jumped into a story because Scott had taken me sailing a few times. Scott's a great sailor specifically on the San Francisco Bay. And if you're lucky enough, he'll take you under the Golden Gate Bridge. And Yossarian and I sailed with Scott once, I think, maybe twice. One time, Yossarian, I remember you were, I think, the only person that sort of saw through a story that Scott and I were weaving about a sailing trip, but we were adding a little bit of exaggeration to it. And I remember you, like, you stood apart from everyone else because you were sort of adding sort of sarcastic, you know, jokes indicating your disbelief of it. And yet you still allowed the joke to go through. So I think you are more perceptive than you, I think you have cracked the code.
Well, I think he's cracked the code completely, period. Like, the universal code.
Yeah.
I consider, just full disclosure, I consider Yossarian my spirit animal.
Uh-oh.
You know, spirit, like, my spirit animal. You, like, some people have bears and
you have a
dolphin.
Yossarian?
Yeah, mine's Yossarian. Like, for sure.
Nice. Nice.
I'm honored to hear that, and I'll wear that badge with pride. I probably listened too close. I mean, Phish is probably, you know, the one band that taught me to not take it so seriously sometimes, because I get so heavily engaged in every detail I can. You know, I'm definitely one of those people that you don't want to be talking around at a show, because I'll be shushing because I don't want to miss some, you know, important giggle that happens in the middle of a lyric or something. So. So I'm at this Further show, and I realized that Phish is my favorite band because they actually make me feel inspired, like celebrating, laughing, you know, these very uplifting, positive feelings. And, you know, I'm watching this Further show, and they had just played, you know, maybe Loser or a couple of, you know, beautiful but tragic and sad songs. And I was just laughing at myself, like, you know, I don't want to come here to feel down. I want to go to a show and feel uplifted. So I yelled out in the middle of the crowd while Phil was stepping up to the microphone before he started playing the next song. I yelled out, "Haley's Comet!"
Really?
And all these Grateful Dead fans just turned and gave me the dirtiest look. And my friends were kind of moving away from me because we were pretty close to the stage. Anyway, my final transition.
Did you ever get Phil to fill that request?
Haley's Comet. That's like the equivalent of the Freebird guy, right? Yelling Freebird.
Yeah, it's
not funny. No one likes it. And yet, inevitably, some guy doesn't know that it's not funny and yells it.
Freebird.
Jesus. Wasn't somebody, there was a guy that I think went to a ton of Zappa shows, and he was always yelling whipping post, and that ultimately Zappa closed a huge, maybe a majority of his concerts with whipping post because of that guy, apparently. I'm not sure how true that rumor is, but I'd heard that rumor before.
So it does so maybe work, keep, you're saying.
Maybe I'll keep yelling Haley's.
Yeah, so we'll don't see. Give up. It does work. That's awesome. Now, Yossarian, there's something that happened to you. I don't know if you want to or if you can talk about it, but sort of a crazy thing in a theater. Was it the Warfield? And
the Warfield Theater.
I think you probably know what I'm talking about. Can you fill us in, or perhaps you might not be able to? I'm not sure exactly how that works.
Well, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's actually the 11th anniversary on Friday, I believe, of that
really
sad but intense event. But yeah, I ended up going off the edge of a balcony during a show, during the intermission of a Phil and Friend show on May 19th of 11 years ago. And I can't talk about it really. You know, I'm super apologetic. I did hurt somebody that's, you know, in our scene, and, you know, paid a fair amount of money to make sure that she was okay and clear my name on that stuff. And, you know, if anybody wanted to talk to me about it in person, I'd probably be more than willing to share. I'm not hiding anything, but at the same time, to publicly discuss it feels a little like I'm opening myself and potentially this other person up to some, you know, darker criticisms, I guess.
I get it. Yeah. Well, no. Well, thank you for saying what you did. I just, you know, my job as a podcaster is to get to the bottom of everything. So I had to ask. And thank you for being forthcoming about that. So we won't go any further on that. However, I do want to say, I believe Scott was there that night.
Yeah. We were there.
Scott was there. He actually followed me to the hospital.
Yeah. And
friend.
I think the one thing the only thing I can say about this, and I hope I'm not stepping out of line or anything, but you know, I know that, you know, so Yossarian was not trying to kill himself. He wasn't trying to hurt anybody. It wasn't anything like that. Like, I just want everybody to know that.
Okay.
And it was unfortunate what happened. It was a crazy, crazy night. I'll say.
Okay.
It made Yossarian and I, anyway, like I became much closer with Yossarian after that, because I really identified with, you know, what he went through. And I've done some really stupid things and crazy things in my life.
Right.
And, so, you know, I really, really became close. I felt spiritually close to Yossarian after that event.
Got it.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I mean, you know, there were several people that I met that weekend that still continue to be very dear to me and close friends. And, you know, there was a lot of people that, while a lot of people were upset, and I can totally understand that. And you know, I had a bit of an online presence. I had a little bit of a name because of pretty much my dad and being in the scene for a long time. So, you know, being online, a lot of people knew what happened. A lot of people knew who, you know, that it was me. I got a lot of grief for it. I didn't hide from it. You know, I was pretty straightforward with all that. But, you know, there were certainly some people that aren't condoning anything like that, but really were there for me in a lot of ways. And I want to, you know, express the appreciation for the human spirit to have some measure of compassion, understanding for stuff when it goes sideways in your life. So,
right.
But now, in a related thing, like the only way that even accomplished, like one thing I don't even think Tom knows, that I happen to know, is like that you were like a championship level hacky sack footbag net player. Is that right? Like, is it called footbag net?
Yeah.
Could you describe for our audience? Could you describe for our audience who haven't heard of it what this game, how it's played?
Sure. It's kind of based on a Thai sport called Buka Takra, actually. And it's a very firm hacky sack, so not soft and squishy, but a lot firmer. And you use a series of bumps, sets, and spikes, much like volleyball, over a 5-foot net, only using your feet. So with 5 feet net, you've got to be flexible. You've got to be able to jump. You know, a lot of times you're reaching over the net to kick the ball. you know, into the ground ideally. And I competed in this for many years. Was one of the reasons I actually didn't get to see fish a lot in the 90s, because I used all of my vacation time to go compete around the world with this little known sport. It's probably, you know, smaller even than ultimate frisbee, but kind of on that same level where there's clubs in different cities around the world. And, you know, they'd host different contests and the world championship would travel from one city to the next. But I wasn't a world champion. I came in second in the world. It was my greatest accomplishment in that sport. And so, yeah, there was a certain amount of athleticism that I've enjoyed, at least in my younger days.
That's incredible. So you're so physically you kind of got to sort of be a peak athlete, at least in that sport. You know, no matter the size of the sport, that's still obviously a notable accomplishment. But you traveled around the world. I read on Facebook an amazing post you did after you came back from Peru, where you were exercising your mind in an extreme way as well.
Yeah. And I still do exercise my mind in this way. Yeah, I went down there for some ayahuasca ceremonies and shat literally, and sat literally with these Shipibo tribe, for lack of a more official term, shamans or ayahuasqueros, maestro and maestras down there, people that for at least 1,000, if not longer, years, maybe a couple thousand years, have been mixing these two totally different plants and boiling them for a couple of days straight down to a very strong tea. And it's an entheogen or a psychedelic, if you want to use that word. But it's been used for healing with these Amazon tribes from Ecuador down through Brazil for a couple thousand years. You know, it's considered a medicine down there. It's certainly not a drug that you take in the traditional way drugs are taken. And for the most part, you know, when you take it, you don't necessarily feel good. You might actually feel horrible. You can, you know, purge, meaning you can, you know, throw up, or it can come out the other end, or it can come out both ends at the same time. You might feel a lot of physical distress and a lot of mental and emotional distress. Well, it'll take you into traumatic points in your past and help you, you know, relive and release them, essentially. So
you've described it as, at least just now, kind of a ritualized ceremony where you take this, and it's not, and like you said, it's not something you would do on a regular basis, but it's to help you cleanse your mind and your spirit, kind of thing.
And your body. Yeah, it's a purgative. And so it does help you release toxins as well. So it really is like a mind, body, and spirit cleanser is a really good way to describe it.
Wow.
And that's not always comfortable. Sometimes it's incredibly beautiful and sometimes it's incredibly challenged. They say actually that you go really to one of three places or all three on the same night or some combination of these three, but you either go to school, the hospital, or church.
Incredible. You told the Facebook community that doing this ayahuasca ceremony rid you of alcohol and marijuana.
Yeah. Well, I went down there actually from, you know, for some addiction issues. And, you know, I wasn't an active user at the time, but kind of like the song Sand, where it talks about, you know, treating symptoms as opposed to treating the cause. You know, just because I had cleaned up and gotten rid of this, the symptoms, didn't necessarily mean the underlying cause was taken care of. So, after reading and studying about ayahuasca for a while, it felt like this was something that would get to the root cause of why you might go into addiction. Or, you know, and again, it does everything from treat, you know, depression, PTSD, physical ailments as well. So I got very intrigued and went down there, and I actually never brought cannabis up in my discussion with, you know, these curanderos, these shamans down there. You go down and you tell them why you're there, and then they'll, you know, give you some other plant medicines besides ayahuasca for the, you know, the 12 days that I was there. And and, you know, you set your intention going into these experiences so that, you know, you're focused on what you're trying to clear up. But I never brought up cannabis. But the funny part is, and I don't speak Shipibo, and it's, which is, you know, their language is separate from Spanish, though they know some Spanish as well. And when they come around during the ceremonies, they actually sing in front of you. And this helps you release whatever it is that you're trying to let go of. And they came around, and the only word I ever recognized whenever they sat in front of me was cannabis, or marijuana, actually. And so I'd hear marijuana, and I just thought it was very strange, because, you know, for besides the 2 weeks that I kind of let go of everything before going down to Peru, I was a pretty regular marijuana user. And they clearly saw it in me, is my only explanation for it, is that they saw that I was using cannabis quite a bit. It, of course, has kind of a foggy effect in your life. And I think they were trying to clear that fog from me to go through this healing. And when I came back, it was prescribed to, you know, not do any cannabis or any drugs. There's a pretty strict diet both before and after you go. So there's 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after. So I came home, didn't smoke for 2 weeks. And then even after that, I didn't really want to smoke as much anymore, like barely ever. I think I didn't smoke for probably 9 or 10 months. And then when I did, it was either, you know, maybe at a fish show, or maybe, you know, I play music myself, so maybe before, you know, rehearsing, playing some music. But besides that, I it just went away. Like, I didn't have any, you know, strong desire to go do it. And now when I do it, it's, you know, it's something I kind of contemplate, and I'll go, yeah, that sounds good. Huh. But most of the time I'm like, no, I don't want to do that right now. So,
well, the reason, and I'm sure you know, Yossarian, that I asked about pot, specifically cannabis, is because this current stage of your life, you're incredibly involved with it, apart from not smoking it, in every other way you can be.
That's true. Yeah, I'm the current CEO of Leaf Cannabis. That's L-E-A-P-H, like fish, Leaf Cannabis Company in Washington State. We're a legal, recreational, and medicinal cannabis producer and processor. We grow and sell wholesale to all recreational stores here in the state. And we're in the top 30 businesses in the state out of about 1,300 producer processors. And fish has inspired me in many ways with elements of the business, not only including the name. You can go to leaf.com, L-E-A-P-H.com.
How'd you get involved in this?
In 2012, I decided, you know, I was growing in the medicinal market here, and I was just selling to a couple different medicinal stores, essentially. And I decided I was going to enter the High Times Cannabis Cup. And I entered that cup and won first place for the hybrid strain cactus, which I named in part after Mike Gordon and in part due to the entheogenic cactus of both peyote and huachuma out of South America. And when I won it, actually Jen Bernstein, who you, I believe, was on your podcast not too long ago, I didn't know her at the time. I didn't even know she was a fish fan. But once I won the award, you know, we get marched up on stage. I got to speak a few words, and then taken to this backstage area where I get put in front of a High Times, you know, big photo op. And Jan Bernstein was there interviewing me, asking me, you know, some questions about the strain and how I got started or something. And at the time, I didn't know who she was. And then only through, I think, Facebook, I started going, that girl keeps talking about High Times and she's in the fish world. I think that's the girl. And I finally met her at Mag Ball last year. And so, yeah. Won the High Times Cannabis Cup, went to Peru shortly thereafter, a couple of months later, came to this realization that I really wanted to build a recreational cannabis business, and did it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
So yeah, Jen Bernstein. So we've both been interviewed by Jen. Hi, Jen. How are you? I'm sure she's listening. That's great. So now, how many cannabis cups have you won since? What sort of volume are you producing? How many employees do you have? That kind of thing.
We have 34 employees and 20 plus investors. We're in 60 stores. I've got two other founders that I work with currently. We're originally a 4-person team, and let's see, we do $250,000 a month in cannabis sales. We're producing 105,000 grams. I can't do the math in terms of pounds right this second, but
wow,
a lot of cannabis. It's a lot of cannabis, and not only that, but you know, we're in a 66,000 square foot building, and we're only using about 20% of it right now. So we're currently in the middle of raising money to continue our build out and to get to full scale. We're allowed to grow up to 30,000 square feet of cannabis canopy with our license. And so we're currently raising money, which brings me to a really funny thing I definitely want to share. We were invited we're accepted to go present in front of a bunch of potential investors in the cannabis market down by this group called the ArcView Group. And they have events in different cities. And so they had an event down in Austin, and we were invited to go present to try to, you know, convince investors to invest in us. And I went and spoke on behalf of the company, and they asked at one point during this application process what music I would like to march out to. And without any hesitation, I said Tweezer Reprise. And walked out to Tweezer Reprise, exited the stage to Tweezer Reprise. And the funny part, you know, my partners, not familiar with Phish. They know I'm a huge Phish fan. But they said, oh, what music do you want to walk out to? I said, it's already been decided. There's no discussion about this. And my partner Martha was like, what do you mean? What do you mean it's been decided? And I'm like, it's done. I mean, just trust me. And she said, well, can we at least hear it? So I, you know, put on the studio version of it, and which is what I marched out to the studio version of it. She's like, oh, okay, cool. I like this. There's clearly some Phish fans there, because I was complimented by several people down there, like, on a great music choice for walking out. But it was a no-brainer. I mean, a couple of my friends, I asked them, what music do you think I should walk out to? And they immediately said Tweezer Reprise. So, you know, if anything's going to pump you up to go out and have an enticing talk, that's the song.
and then the Super Bowl copied you by having the Atlanta team march out to Tweezer Reprise.
There was the Olympic ones, too, with
Michael Phelps. But,
yeah, Phelps, there was like a montage of all of his wins that they played Tweezer Reprise to as well. So it's starting to become iconic with, you know, winning, essentially.
Well, we're trying to create another Jen Bernstein, and your cannabis stuff is sort of appropriate. We're trying to turn the newish song Blaze On into a, you know, a cannabis anthem. And when I say we, I kind of mean Jen and me. This isn't necessarily like a Phish endorsed enterprise. But maybe you can help.
Yeah, I've been thinking that the company does need a jingle of some sort. I don't know if Phish would allow us to use Blaze On, but that would certainly be fitting.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes.
I give my permission. Yes. Yeah. Say yes. There you go, man.
There you go. You got the permission. You got your nice shades on, and the worst days are gone. So now the band plays on. You got one life, blaze on. You got your nice shades on, and the worst days are gone. So now the band plays on. You got one life, blaze on.
Something else that really inspired our me that has been a huge positive positive motion in our business was at Magnaball. I came up with the idea, you know, I love art. So, I mean, I don't just have my father's posters. I collect, you know, Phish posters and other pieces of art that aren't involved with rock and roll and stuff. I really am drawn to painting and stuff. And I came up with this idea during Magnaball that I really wanted to get a different artist to do a different piece of art for each of the strains that we grow. So I did that. And we work with, you know, some are pretty big names, Amanda Sage and Jeff Wood, who's done some Phish art, and, you know, many of the other popular names in the Phish community have offered to do some art for us as well. And, you know, as we expand the amount of strains, we'll be adding more art. So everyone does, it's a different animal. So, you know, and if it's, for example, a heavy indica that's going to make you really sleepy, we put a sloth on it. And if it's, you know, something that's really uplifting, we'll put a hummingbird on it, for example. So each strain, different artists, different, and we put the name of the artist on there too. I wanted to promote, you know, not just our brand, but promote the artist as well. And we put, you know, put a little write up about them on our website. And sometimes we'll write about it on our, you know, Facebook or Instagram posts. And, we ended up winning, the best packaging award in Washington State.
Well, that's become a huge part of your brand, that whole thing, right? And it really does.
Yeah,
It really does seem to tie kind of like your life together, like because of the whole, you know, your father and the poster thing. And then like with this, it sort of brings it all together now, you know, like Leaf and like you're really including you into this product.
Yeah. Well, my father passed in 2008. And, you know, of course, if he hadn't passed, I would have asked him to do our logo or do some artwork for us just because that would be amazing. And but since he's passed and I still love art and there's all these people I've gotten to know in part because of who my dad is and my love for art. I've gotten to know all these artists. So I just thought, it's kind of a tribute to him as well of, you know, look at all this beautiful, colorful art that's out there and kind of promote that. I was calling it cross-pollination where we're supporting the artists and they're also supporting our brand essentially.
Yeah. Your site is amazing. Like if you go to leaf.com and you click through your brands, your different strains, it is like looking at an art gallery. It's just amazing. It's thumbing through there.
Yeah. And we look forward to expanding on that. So
it's a lot of fun. That brings up one question. I'm sorry to kind of over talk you. I think that's one of our inherent problems with the cross-country interview is that sometimes we talk over each other. But the question I had is the marijuana that you sell, is that going across the country? Like, could I get it in New Jersey or is it legally only confined to Washington?
Just Washington. Yeah. We're only allowed to sell to other licensed stores within Washington state. Yeah. So, highly regulated.
So it seems like a tremendous amount of pot that just you're making. And you said you're one of 1800 growers. So there's so much pot being smoked.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's growing every year. It's doubled in size every year since it started, in terms of, the market. But it's very competitive. And if anything, I think there's a massive flood of cannabis of varying degrees of quality. We pride ourselves in putting out a real top shelf product, but that being said, there's so much on the market that it's really, you know, it's pushed the cost, per gram essentially, pretty low. And we get a premium price because we are a premium product and pride ourselves on that. But
I've always kind of said to my friends that, you know, we're going to look back at this time as a golden age of beer because we're completely in a craft beer nirvana without any question. No doubt you can go and get the most amazing beer.
Yes.
Even in your corner 7-Eleven store, you can get incredible beer that just even 10 years ago you could only get Bud Light or Heineken or something like that. You can now almost say that about marijuana, apart from the fact that it's not legal in every state, but soon I guess we're in a golden age of pot too.
Well, Jeff Sessions might have something to say about that. You worried about that at all, yo, about Sessions coming and cracking down and you know what?
You know, maybe in the short term, I mean, you know, if anything, I'm a little bit glad that full legalization isn't happening overnight. It allows us to kind of get established and grow our brand in a relatively small market. I think when it goes fully national, there's just going to be this, you know, massive flood of new businesses, and it takes a little while for the industry to mature. And there's so much complexity to running a big operation like this. Very few people in America have been able to grow this scale. And with the amount of regulations, and we have 220 cameras on site that have to record 45 days at a time, and every single gram and every single plant is tracked with a specific, 16-digit code that we enter into a computer system that's monitored by the state, and they're allowed to come in at any time and, you know, weigh and count every single plant or every gram that we have on site to make sure that we're not taking cannabis out of it and, you know, taking it over state lines and such. So I think Jeff Sessions, I don't think he'll come into the recreational states. If he was to, my guess is that he would probably just go after bad players. If people were growing it, quote unquote, legally, but then smuggling out of their facility and taking it out of state or selling it to kids or something, I think he might crack down on them, which, he's certainly putting a bit of a pall across the cannabis community right now. It's pretty backwards thinking in my view. I hope that, this doesn't last too long, but I don't think in the long run it will have much of an effect. 60% of the U.S. wants it to be legal. 70% of the people in the U.S. want the states to make their own decisions on how they treat it. So,
I think you're right.
I'm not going to let Scott turn this Under the Scales into a political podcast or podcast. I know he wants to, because and with Scott, if you're talking politics, it always ends in yelling and then crying.
Sorry.
So we're not going to do that. But to you, Yossarian, I think we've kept you for a long time. I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day, even though it is a Sunday. I know you're a busy guy. And thank you very much. And I really enjoyed talking to you.
It's been an honor to be invited to talk with you. And I love the fish community so much. It's been great to get to know you. I think you doing a podcast is timely. And, I think a lot of people are tuning in and listening to what you got to talk about. I think sometimes you need people to interview you, because very few people want to hear what I have to say, but I think a lot of people want to hear what you have to say, Tom. So thank you for having me on, and Scott, welcome back to the United States.
Yeah, man.
Well, I really appreciate that. And no, man, it's the interesting variety of people on my podcast that make people tune in. And yes, now and then I do get some questions about me. And fortunately, I've stumbled into this new format, of which Scott was the first, where the audience asks me questions. So look for that podcast. That happened a couple of podcasts ago, and that one's called Question and Answer 1. And soon we're about to come out with 2 and 3. We have them all planned already. But anyway, thank you, Yossarian, very much. And I might as well just say it, blaze on.
Blaze on, yeah.
Thanks a lot.